Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm David Hamilton Golland, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Charlie Sawyer about his book, B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to join you.
Thank you. I wonder if we could begin the interview with you telling us a bit about yourself.
Comes to mind Sonny Boy Williamson's great song, Don't Start Me to Talkin', I'll Tell Everything I Know. So I'm born in 1941, makes me 81 years old. I'm retired. I live north of Boston in a semi-rural town with my wife. I have a son who lives in New York City. He's 30 years old. And I'm retired from all my professions. And the last 3 years, I've been working intensely on this book, which was published only a few weeks ago, in the tail end of August.
And it is a beautiful book, B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon. By its size, it has the look of a coffee table book, and it is replete with, dare I say, hundreds of photos?
Yes, hundreds.
Almost all of which include B.B. King. Some include yourself. How did you meet the great B.B. King?
I met him in 1968 when he was booked into a famous jazz room north of Boston, a small club seating about 200 people. And he was booked for an extended stay. I think it was 9 days, so bridging 2 weekends. And being a small club, this gave me easy access up close to the stage because the tables for the visitors were right up to the edge of the stage. So I could get real proximity during his performances. And I met him during an intermission. He introduced himself to me and integrated me into his conversation. He was very friendly. He made me feel at ease at once. And I came back night after night. I had a million questions. I had a tape recorder and a notebook and a camera. And he was always gracious and always put me at my ease. And that was the start of a friendship that went on until he died in 2015.
And it wasn't just you. He sort of had a way with people, did he not?
Yes, he had a gift, I would say, a great talent for establishing intimacy with people, even for 10, 20 seconds and under almost any circumstance. He gave you this feeling that you were the only person that mattered to him in that moment. He always gave you his full attention. And he had a great repertoire of social graces. And he lived in a world where those graces were not so common and very important.
He also employed them on the stage in his interactions with the audience.
Yes, all of his performances were a conversation in one way or another. And this was true, I think, from the very beginning. And it didn't matter the size of the audience, the nationality of the audience, the race. None of these things were obstacles to his great capacity. And he gave an estimated 18,000 performances. He never took a real vacation.
Wow.
And from the 1940s in Memphis, straight through, he played 342 one-night stands in 1956 and worked the other nights of the year.
Incredible.
Mm.
And as a result of your collaboration with him through your photography and through all the questions you were asking of him, and indeed through some bona fide historical research, archival research, and in fact, you were able to publish your first book about B.B. King in 1980, and then you updated that biography in the 1990s when you added a chapter for a publisher looking to do a translation. What prompted you to add to the canon now with this book?
Well, I've always known that I had this archive of my photography. The Arrival of B.B. King, that's the title of the 1980 biography. The Arrival of B.B. King had a lot of photographs, but it was a standard biography, and the photographs were all gathered together in two or three sections, mm-hmm. and they were there to illustrate the text. And time and again, I would have chosen the best picture to illustrate one thing or another. And yet, this was really kind of the best of a cluster of really powerful photographs. So when I retired in 2015, I retired from my career in software. I began turning to digitizing my archive. I think I have every photograph I ever took, BB and others. And I began amassing what was needed for a digital studio. And I began scanning my photographs. And there was this prize waiting for me, which was the archive of BB photographs, which were, I estimate, around 3,000 photographs. Mm-hmm. I had a relationship with the B.B. King Museum. I had been consulting to the museum during its planning. So I contacted them and said, I think I have the basis of a photographic book. I visited them down there. They invited me to come down to Mississippi. And we worked out a way of making a book which is first and foremost a photographic album. Mm-hmm. So I want to emphasize this. From Indianola to Icon is a lot of things, but most importantly, it is a photographic work. And it's based on the photographs that I hope people will judge the quality of the work. So I began mining this rich lore and writing to accompany it. And the museum encouraged me, and eventually I found a publisher, a fantastic publisher, Schiffer Books. And it was 3 years of hard work. And now it's out.
And congratulations on it being out. The cover photo, the cover image, is B.B. King with his arms outstretched, taking in the adulation of a crowd and giving it back to them. And it also, it has a connection to that museum in Indianola. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, the museum adopted this profile of B.B. It's an unusual profile because you don't see BB's face, you don't see his features, because it's taken from slightly behind, looking across from behind. And very important is that his guitar, which is hanging off his shoulder, is
Lucille.
Clearly and dramatically represented. So you have this pose of the Redeemer, the Redemption, with his arms stretched and his head turned back, and Lucille thrusting out. So it was very graphic, and the museum planners recognized that that would be a good symbol for the museum, and they adopted it, and it's now part of the logo of the museum.
You might even call it the icon.
The icon,
museum.
and that same image has a place in Jackson, Mississippi, in the Museum of Mississippi History. Mm-hmm. They contacted me, and they licensed the use of the picture, and they turned it into a mural-sized relief. So it's, it's like 2.5 dimensions, and it hangs in there. In their main gallery, now I hear my chair squeaking. I'm sorry. Well, I can't help that. Yes. So, I mean, that's your question was, how did you come to this? Well, it was in order to realize the great power of my archive, which now the text. Is to support the images, whereas the previous biography, the images were there as illustrations for the text.
Yes, yes. Now, you've divided this book into two sections. Can you speak a bit about the structure, why you chose it, what it does for the book?
Well, the first section, book one, is chronicling B.B.'s... I don't know what to call it, his migration, his transition from the Chitlin circuit to mainstream, to Las Vegas, to the most prestigious stages in the world. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, there's a kind of shift in the nature of the narrative. The story of this book is the story of the previous book, the actual narrative line. And once the book of 1980 is published, there's a natural kind of transition to the side effects, what happened with the book after it was published and what happened with Bibi's career. That's the rationale.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. We are speaking with Charles Charlie Sawyer about his book, B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon, published this year by Schiffer Publishing. I'd like to switch gears a bit, Charlie, and talk about what must have been a difficult section for you to write. Your second wife, Bystra Lankova, died in a tragic car accident. You include a photo of the two of you with B.B. King in 1980, and you've written elsewhere about the tragedy, but you elected not to recount what happened to her in this book. As a writer, how did it feel to revisit this painful episode in your life, and how did it affect your process?
Well, that's the hardest question I've been asked so far, I think. The idea of revisiting the tragedy kind of supposes that somehow the tragedy is not with me when it inhabits my life all the time. I was injured in the same catastrophic auto accident. And I had PTSD in the aftermath, and I managed to climb out of the well of PTSD with Bystra's closest friend, who is now my wife Sherry Hoyt, and is the editor of this book. And I think that's as much as I can say. I don't know that it affects my process. I mean, okay, what's my process? Well, my process is now very much involved in Bistra's, Sherry's editing. She edited every line, every photograph in this book. Nothing gets out of this house, nothing I write gets out of this house without her, her brilliant editing. There is this continuous narrative that as we wind all the way back, how did Sherry appear in my life? Well, she was Bistra's closest friend. Well, how did Bistra appear in my life? And, you know, soon you're to the fact I was born in 1941. So I think it's about all I could say on that. But thank you for the question.
Oh, that's okay. But I think if we do take it a little bit back with Bistra, there's a moment of serendipity that I think you recount incredibly well in the book in 1980, where you and Bistra and B.B. King are in Cambridge. And maybe if you could talk a little bit about the importance of that moment in time for not just for this book that has ultimately come out of it and for this scene, but also in terms of questions of music and questions of race and questions about the American story.
Yes, the important thing about that that day when B.B. was a guest at Harvard is to know that he was a guest at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism, which is a very prestigious institution, which has been, I couldn't tell you how far back, it's long-standing. And it is a year-long, academic year-long program in which journalists are given the journalists move with their families to Cambridge, and they are supported by the Nieman Foundation. And the selection of each Nieman class is an attempt to balance the nationality and the type of journalism. And Bistra, who came from Eastern Europe as part of the National Film and Television Organization, she was a executive producer of feature films. She was a Nieman Fellow the year before. She lived in Cambridge. And quite by chance, I had met her during that year before. Now, the important thing here in terms of B.B. and his career is the Nieman Fellows are selected as the next generation of superstars as journalists. And in fact, there were Pulitzer Prizes. And B.B. was a dinner guest and came with his rhythm section and set up in the library at the Lippmann House, the headquarters of the Nieman Foundation. And he made it clear that he would come, but he would not come to give a speech. He would only speak when he had his guitar in his hands. So after the lunch, we went to the library with no public address, no PA system, nothing to amplify his voice, and tiny little amplifiers and a snare drum with brushes, he gave a little concert. Now, you have to know that this gave him an intimacy with some of the most powerful journalists and trendsetters and taste setters in the coming decades. One of the fellows there became the managing editor of the New York Times editorial page, for example. Mm-hmm. So it was Biestra's connection to the Nieman Foundation, which secured the invitation for Bibi to come and be a guest. And when I walked with him to the car after all of this, and this, by the way, there's a whole chapter in my book about this day and this visit. On the way to the car, I said, they're going to send you a check for $100 for being a speaker. And he said, I don't need it. You keep it. Use it to buy a ring for the lady. Well, okay, we weren't yet planning to get married, but we did get married like three or four weeks later. So there was a real connection here, which continued. And then when Sherry and I married and had a son, my son grew up feeling as if his grandfather was B.B. King.
Mm-hmm.
Should I tell the story about the dressing room and the shower stall and Lucille?
By all means.
So this was the first time when Sherry and I had a chance to bring our son, Sam, three-year-old Sam, to meet B.B. when he was playing here in Massachusetts. We had a grand and warm reunion in his dressing room, and Sam started, wandering around, and there was a shower and toilet right off the dressing room, and Sam found his way to the toilet that had this spring handle, which he engaged, and it made a huge sound, and he loved it. So the second thing he did was to fire off the toilet again, and I got nervous. I said, Sam, and Bibi said, don't interfere. Let him have his fun. Well, after a little while, Sam grew tired of the toilet, and then his attention came to Lucille, the guitar, on a guitar stand, standing up in the shower stall. And he started toward Lucille, and I gasped. And Bibi said, no, don't interfere. Let him check it out. Let him explore. And Sam came and felt Lucille, ran his fingers up and down the strings, and then went on to the next thing for his attention. So our family life had a component for Bibi and our sons growing up as B.B. King as a family member.
What an incredible story, and what an incredible moment.
Yes.
You've talked about how Sherry edits everything before it ever gets out of the house, I think was what you said.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about your process. I think a lot of our listeners are writers themselves. Can you tell us about your workspace, how you go about the act of writing, any particular preferences or tools that you use?
Well, I find that the keyboard works rather well when my fingers are on it. That's my process, my method. My process. I think through my hands onto the screen, and I'm not afraid to be wrong. I'm not afraid to be awkward. I'm not afraid. Mm-hmm. The important thing is to keep the flow going. I have a studio office room, which is primarily for my photography. I have a big printer. I'm surrounded by books, and I have prints up on the wall of my work. I have a photograph that I took when I was 11 years old. And right above that is a portrait of my parents standing in front of the front door. Very striking, very friendly portrait of them, and they're both gone by now, by the way. And I greet them every morning. I start my working day with an entry in a day book to give the day and the time at which I start. Today, Monday, October 3rd, I started at 10:30. I take my blood pressure. This morning, it was at 10:30, it was 142/77. And I write down the, over on the side, I have a few notes to prepare for today. And I use Microsoft Word. I always have projects going. And my current attention, besides things like what we're doing right now, is working on a memoir. I've been contemplating a memoir for a long time. And you could see this book we're discussing today,
yes,
as a kind of book in a series of books of my memoir, because the text in from Indianola to Icon recounts my odyssey starting at Lenny's on the Turnpike in 1968 and ending with my eulogy at Bibi's funeral.
Yes.
And I do talk about occasionally about other things in my life, but that's where my focus is right now. Eventually I show everything to Sherry, and she is a brilliant line editor. She's the best that I've, she will spot every passive voice and turn it around to active voice. She'll find a better word. She irons out the wrinkles. You know, I provide the raw stuff and she makes it sing. Mm. So we are a pair. We are a writing team.
Like B.B. King and Lucille.
Exactly. So I'm not sure which one I am. Whether I'm Lucille or B.B.
We are speaking with Charles Sawyer about his book, B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon, available now at Amazon and directly through the press at schifferbooks.com. Schiffer spelled S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R. And while we were preparing for this interview, you asked me about Daniel Devizet's 2021 biography of B.B. King. What are your thoughts on his book?
Well, I'm a great fan of the book and a great admirer of Dan. He interviewed me at some length. His book is a complete and thorough and exhaustive and beautifully written biography of B.B. King. There are decades that my writing did not cover, which mm-hmm. Dan's does cover. We each wrote a blurb for the other's book, and his blurb, which appears right on the back of my book, says, "Nobody knows the B.B. King story better than Charlie Sawyer." And I just gushed with gratitude when I read that. And I said to myself, yes, that may be true, but only because I read Dan's book. So we became friends.
I'm sure
friends.
You're just being modest.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, so I'm a great... If you really wanted to know B.B. King and to have a feeling of intimacy with him in his life, buy both books.
By all means. Other than the stories you've already told, what is your most enduring memory of B.B. King?
My most enduring memory. Oh, my gracious. Well, I have a lot of individual memories that that I think are representative of the man. I remember a fan. Just a second, David. You all right, dear? That's Sherry downstairs with a twisted ankle.
Mm.
But
a new twisted ankle? Do you need to go?
Just no. She says she calls. She's all right. But
okay.
Okay. So two very specific incidents.
Mm-hmm.
One, which would have been in the late '60s, when Albert King, the blues guitarist.
Yes.
Was getting a lot of attention and had been presented by some publicists as a relative of B.B. King. And so this fan said, B.B., are you really Albert King's brother? And he said, no, we're not brothers. Are you his half-brother? Hmm. Well, no, but we go as brothers, he said. And she said, but are you any relation to Albert King? And B.B. said, my name was King before I was famous.
Huh.
Now, you have to know that Albert King's real name was Albert Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
He took the name King because it suited him as a persona. It was a nom de musique, if you will,
mm-hmm.
which nobody would challenge. I mean, he was Albert King.
B.B. was Riley King.
Riley King, yes.
Yeah.
And the other incident, which is very similar, was a young fan, a girl introduced herself, and she said, I'm so-and-so's daughter. You remember so-and-so? And B.B. said, oh, I'm sure I met him. Well, no, you and he were really, really good friends. And B.B. said, well, I'm sure we would be friends. And she said, no, you used to go fishing together. You and my dad were fishing buddies. You used to fish in Arkansas. And B.B. said, I'm sorry, young lady. I've never been fishing in Arkansas. Now, would you like to join us here? Can I get you something? So when pressed, yes. I have to stop, David. I'm sorry. Can we pause this?
Yes, I'm clicking pause.
I'm coming.
And you were saying?
Yes. These two small stories are representative to me of B.B.'s consideration for people,
mm-hmm.
And his insistence on the truth. The way he, this young lady who's evidently her father bragged about his being close pals with B.B., and
mm-hmm.
this put her in a very bad situation. You could tell how she was becoming more and more stressed, and she was demanding that B.B. pretend to, he would have had to pretend to know her father, mm-hmm. and he would not pretend in order to go along with her. And he immediately tried to make her feel comfortable and reassure her. I mean, these are very small details, but that and keep the money and buy a ring for the lady, as if he knew what we were poised to do.
Mm-hmm.
Back
an
there.
Incredibly generous moment.
Yes. Well, I tell the story in the book in the back about a time when I met him by accident in a way. I was checking out of a motel in Mississippi when he was checking in, and we had a visit. He invited me to come and have coffee with him in his room. And I mentioned, this was not a scheduled visit at all. This was just friends getting together. And I mentioned that I had been laid off from my job, so I was a bit of a rough patch. And he said, let me give you some money. And I said, no, I'm not asking for money. He said, let me give you some. I want to help you. And he started fishing in his coat pocket and in his shoulder bag and so on. And he laid out 10 $100 bills on the table between us and said, please take them. First my pride was going to speak. No. And then I said, hey, I am unemployed and I have a family and he wants to help. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. Then I said, we were planning on getting Sam a good acoustic guitar for Christmas. But then when I got laid off, we said, well, that'll have to wait. And now with this money, we can buy that guitar and put it under the tree from B.B. King. Mm-hmm. And B.B. said, whatever you decide to do with it is fine with me. And the story really ends when Sam brought that guitar with him the next time when we met with B.B., and B.B. autographed the guitar. So, this narrative captures the generosity of the man.
Yes.
It's also during all of those years that I was following him, he was not subsidizing me in any way, nor was the publisher. I was buying the plane tickets out of my pocket, basically.
You were writing on spec.
On spec, yeah. The whole thing is on spec. Yeah.
And you had a difficult beginning to your career as a writer, but in a sense, you lived the blues. So one thing we haven't spoken about much today is the music itself. What is it about the blues and what is it about B.B. King that has made for such compelling American music?
Okay, the idea of the blues is it has a very simple musical structure, which can be employed and with some variety here and there, but it's always musically very simple. And it's highly individualistic music. It's a solo artist or a duo or a combo or even a real band, horns and all that. But it's highly individual music. And the goal is always to invest the music with the maximum emotion, the deepest and most intimate feelings to be expressed in the music itself, played in this narrow, very rudimentary form. Mm-hmm. Now, what B.B. did was to establish the voice of the guitar and to develop a kind of vocabulary for this quest for the deep, deep expression. The voice of the guitar in live performance was his calling card. And except for a few live performances, his recordings are studio recordings in which he does not replicate the voice of his live guitar. And I was dying to ask him why he seemed to avoid that distinctive voice in the studio. And I got to ask him that question when he was my guest at my class at Harvard in my History of Blues course. And he said, in the studio, you have the luxury of shaping the sound in ways that you cannot on a live stage. And in the studio, he said, I play the guitar the way I think I want the guitar to sound. But when I'm performing, I have to settle for what I can get out of the amplifier on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that explained it for me. You know, I could read to you from my eulogy so that we could have in this interview for the record my my understanding of the legacy of Bibi's musical life. Shall I do that?
I think that would be wonderful.
Okay. So this is Appendix D in my book, Requiem for a King, remarks read at the Belgrove Missionary Baptist Church in Indianola, Mississippi, May 30th, 2015. And I'm going to skip straight to the paragraph where I try to account for Bibi's legacy. In the distant future, many generations hence, when the history of the 20th century will reside only in books and other artifacts, people will hear blues music and recognize it as a distinct art form, different from jazz, different from rock and roll, different from soul music. And in these distant times, music will be performed and loved, just as 18th and 19th century classical music is performed and loved today. And it is B.B. King who has won for blues this place in our culture. He, more than anyone, is responsible for securing a permanent place for blues in our very cultural imprint. His unique story gave the listening public a persona to identify with the music. His story became the story of the blues. B.B. King has earned a place alongside Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, and Miles Davis in the pantheon of artists who have made the 20th century's new style of improvisational music America's unique contribution to world culture.
The book is B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon. Charles Sawyer, thank you so much for speaking with me today for the New Books Network.
Can we continue? Or are we running out of...
No, we're not running out of this. This is going to have to be edited out. I thought that was a great place to end, but we could continue.
Because I
actually wanted to go back further. I wanted to ask, why B.B. King? What? Where did he... tell us a little bit about where he came from, and what was it about his upbringing? What was it about the African-American experience in the early and mid-20th century that made the blues what it became?
Okay, but before I do that,
sure.
I want to say about this eulogy. When B.B. died, Sherry and I went to Indianola to the museum right away, and the museum asked me to be a kind of a resident historian for the press, and the day before the funeral, I was asked to give a eulogy. So I worked furiously all day and wrote a draft, and then in the evening, Sherry and I went at it hammer and tongs, and I have to credit Sherry for every bit of grace and poetry in the eulogy that I read. And I'll add to that a little story about the reading of the eulogy during the funeral there at the church in Indianola. It was quite a long service, as you can imagine, with a lot of music and choirs and all of that. And while we were sitting there, we're waiting for my turn, and my son leaned over and he said, Dad, when you get up there, get really close to the microphone, because that microphone is really really terrible. Okay, yeah, thank you. A little while later, Sherry said, Charlie, when you get up there, get up really close to the microphone, because that microphone is really poor. I said, okay. Then came my turn, and I stood up and walked up the aisle and up the red carpeted stairs to the podium. Waiting behind the podium, out of sight, was a little man. He said, psst, psst, hey. And I bent down and he said, get up really close to the microphone because it really is terrible. So I stepped up and got close to the microphone. I said, my name is Charlie Sawyer and I wrote a book about B.B. King. And a voice from the audience shouted out, louder! And I recognized that was Sherry's voice. So, anyway, that's the story that goes with the eulogy.
Eulogy.
Okay, so now you ask about B.B. King and about his circumstances and his character.
And what it is that helped me, how it is that those circumstances and character are what helped create the blues.
Well, he had an answer for this. I mean, this was the kind of question interviewers were bound to ask him. And he always laid credit to his school teacher in Kilmichael, Mississippi, when he was living with his grandmother. Luther Henson was his name. And I visited Luther Henson and interviewed him, Bibi's telling about the schooling and about Mr. Hansen, supplemented by Luther Hansen's account of the school and how he taught the kids. It was a one-room schoolhouse. He had as many as 60 or 70 kids in this one room at one time, all grades up to grade 8. And he taught them the obvious 3 R's, but he also taught them practical skills like how to can fruit and how to cultivate fruit trees and how to cook chicken and how to care for livestock. And he also gave them a kind of cultural and psychological education. And I think that he taught Riley self-respect and self-improvement, and that these were deep in his character. Meanwhile, Riley had no siblings, he lived until his mother, when his mother died, he lived then with his grandmother. His grandmother died when he was 14, leaving him alone because he didn't know where his father was. His father was not part of his life. And then began the year 1940. He lived more or less in the cabin where he had lived with his grandmother. And the landlord for that cabin was a farmer who offered him to support him with a monthly stipend if he would share crop 1 acre of cotton and supported him with $2.50 a month. And I knew that this farmer was still alive when I was down there. And I made an appointment and I went and met him at home. He was by then retired. He was a very friendly, very likable man, very open, and he spoke with affection about about Riley and his grandmother and his aunt and uncle and so on. And at one point he said, He stood up and went to a closet and opened the closet, and I could see there this long row of ledger books. And he pulled out one and flipped through it and found the ledger pages for Elnora Farr, grandmother, William Pullian, his uncle, Mimie Stells, his aunt, and Riley King for the year 1940. This is Riley King, 14 years old, sharecropping 1 acre of cotton and living on $2.50 a month.
That's B.B. King as Riley King.
Before B.B. became B.B.
Yes.
When he was still Riley as a boy. Now, I was staring at this page, which showed things like 50 cents for a wrench, that Riley bought a wrench, which means that his landlord bought it for him and charged him, paid for it and charged him on his ledger.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the farmer, I said, if my readers could see this, it would mean so much to them. And he said, if you promise to get them back, I'll let you take these pages. And I said, yes, yes, please. He took a razor and he cut the pages out of the ledger book and handed them to me. So I count this, and this, by the way, except for the 1930 census, is the only real data we have of the existence of Riley King. His birth was not recorded. There is no birth certificate for Riley King.
Mm-hmm.
So this sharecropper's ledger is Riley King's life in the first year that he was really an adult, 14, after his mother. He was living basically alone, raising cotton. I count all of this as a series of miracles. First of all, that it was recorded. Secondly, that the recording survived in Ed Wayne Henderson's closet.
Yes.
Third, that I found Ed Wayne Henderson, and that when I found him, he produced this ledger, and then that he let me take the ledger pages, which I took straight to B.B. King and showed him, laid right on the bed in front of him, so he could see his ledger from that year, which he puzzled over. He couldn't understand what he was looking at when he first saw. I had to explain it to him. This is a kind of series of miracles which are now in my book, so you know the world can share in this miracle.
Yes.
So I could spin this tale a long way. There were people who were kind to Riley, Luther Hansen was black, but the next kindness came from a white farming family that took Riley in and made him, in effect, a member of their family and their household. And he lived with that family. They were white, and he said the head of the family never called him boy. He always called him son or Riley.
Mm-hmm.
And they were his sponsors, his patrons.
Mm-hmm.
The plantation owner in Indianola, Johnson Barrett, was a fair-minded man. Then eventually, many years later, when B.B. King makes a partnership with Sidney Seidenberg, his manager. There's this line of people who were ready to be kind and fair with him. His lack of ties and roots contributed to his fleeing to Memphis when he was about 19, 20 years old. And he had enormous great fortune in his timing. He came there to Memphis the second time, just when WDIA was building a listener base of black listeners by programming for the black community and by hiring black disc jockeys. And they hired Riley King to be the Pepticon boy and was on the radio every day for 15 minutes by himself, playing with his guitar and singing live and advertising Pepticon Tonic. And from there, he went to be the Blues Boy of Beale Street, which shortened to be Blues Boy, which shortened to BB. And it's a story of incredible luck and kindness and enormous character. You know that he, as a boy, he had a stammer. And I think that Luther Henson helped him overcome his stammer. And his guitar playing was instrumental, I think, not to make a pun, in his learning how to be very slow and deliberate in speaking so as not to, stutter. Is that enough?
I think that's more than enough.
Yeah.
So once again, the book is B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon. Charles Sawyer, thank you so much.
Wait, I have more.
You have more.
I have something more that I'm really dying to say.
That's fine. Let's say it.
To speak about the publisher and about this, about the
Yes,
books.
Let's talk about Schiffer Books.
Schiffer Books. They are absolutely unique. They have 9,000 titles in their catalog. Their headquarters are in rural Pennsylvania. They have 60 employees. And you cannot think of a subject that is too exotic or peculiar that they would not be ready to publish a book about it if they had the right author and the right materials.
How's their marketing arm?
They are, that remains to be seen.
Yes.
I'm a case in point. The book is widely available and widely in, online for online purchases, and, physically, available in bookstores. It's only been out for even less than a month. They have a marketing team, and they have standing relations to promote their work.
And this is definitely a trade book rather than an academic book. If I may ask, is this something where are they a press where the author gets an advance, or does the author wait for royalties?
Royalties, no advances. They
only
don't give they don't give
no
advances. The only money I've spent with Schiffer is buying copies of the book. I did not subsidize the production of the book. They have this standing staff, editorial staff and promotional staff and book designers and so on. And judging from the jobs they did on this book, their book designers are fantastic. So they do not give advances, but they invest in the book by producing it.
I will say I caught a couple of the purpose of this interview is not to do a review of the book, but since we're talking about Schiffer, and I hope this isn't you and Sherry, I would have assumed that this is the press, but you correctly spell toxin in terms of T-O-C-S-I-N
right.
in the text.
Yes.
And there are a few places where the pictures have the, I guess, the former editor or the publisher of, what was it, the Jackson or the Indianola?
Indianola Enterprise Toxin.
Enterprise Toxin, where they're spelling it like the chemical, chemical meaning.
Oh, boy. T-O-X-I-N.
Yeah.
Very unusual term.
Yes.
I started with Schiffer with a contract to do a book with about 150 photographs in it. I wanted to do a thorough job of telling the story of the B.B. King Museum. But that is a big story, and it's an important story. It's an important American story. This museum, yes, which now has been open for over 10 years, the building of the museum cost close to $20 million. But the initiative to do the museum and its execution was strictly a local matter. There were no, United Artists, no big promotional entertainment cooperatives that came in and took this over. No, the museum was strictly a local effort there in Indianola, and it was a biracial core of about a half a dozen people. Mm-hmm. Now, the location of Indianola is important. It is Beebe's hometown, the best you can do for a hometown for him. But what is to be said about Indianola? Well, there was a very serious sociological study done in the 1930s and is still available today called...
the color line, something about the...
Caste and class in a southern town. Mm-hmm. And the author spent a year in the southern town, having never mentioned that this southern town is Indianola. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of blueprint for race relations in the Jim Crow period of the South. The other thing to know about Indianola is that's where the White Citizens Council was founded, mm-hmm. Which was the arch segregationist organization. And now there in this town, there is this magnificent museum in honor of a former citizen of Indianola, a black man, a great world-renowned, world-recognized, important artist named B.B. King. That is a story that deserves to be told. Mm-hmm. But to tell it properly, and I was in a position to tell it because I was part of the planning of the museum itself. And I knew all of the people, all the characters, and I watched the museum from groundbreaking all the way to its opening. I went to my editor and I said, I want to do this story. I explained to him the importance of the story. It's an important American story. It's part of B.B. King's story, but it's also important about the South and race relations and all of that. But it will practically double the size of the book. And I can't do that without your approval. And he said, go for it. That's the longest chapter in the book.
Yes.
And it has, like 25 photographs that I took and a few that I didn't take. It is the history of the B.B. King Museum. And after you read it, you'll all want to go there and see it for yourself because it is magnificent. And I can claim a little bit of credit in its creation, and a lot of credit in the telling of the story, and share that credit with Schiffer Books because they said, go ahead, Charlie, it'll make the book better. It will increase its scope, increase its market appeal. And I just about doubled the size of the book and just about doubled its purchase price because they were going to sell it for a lot less before that. Mm-hmm. So that's my agenda. Now you can bid me farewell.
And it's hard to do because it's such, there's so much that you have to tell us. And I have so much enjoyed this conversation, but I do want to leave your listeners something. I want to leave some material in the book so that our listeners have some reason to buy it, mm-hmm. Other than to be able to look at, again, this beautiful cover and all of the beautiful photographs that that are found throughout the book, as you said, more than 150. Well, again, the book is B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon, with Schiffer Press, available at Amazon and at schifferbooks.com, S-C-H-I-F-F-E-R. Charles Sawyer, once again, thank you so much for sitting for this interview and discussing your new book with the listeners at New Books Network.
One last detail.
Yes.
You left out the subtitle of the book.
B.B. King, From Indianola to Icon, A Personal Odyssey with the King of the Blues.
There you go.
Photos and text by Charles Sawyer.
Thank you. Thank you, David. It's a great pleasure. And I enjoyed this tremendously.
Likewise.
Thank you.